Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It is Monday afternoon. This is the Hold That podcast brought to you by The Athletic, which is the best sports writing site out there, y'all. No ads, no BS.
Oh, but T-Bob, isn't that money? Yes, but just a small amount.
TheAthletic.com/HoldThatPodcast. Just $1 a week. $1 a week. How about that? And you get to read Brody Miller's work. Who covers LSU? Brody, what's up, dude? What's going on?
Well, man, it's a bye week, and it's a bye week that I think LSU needs, first off. It's a bye week that I think I need after a hurricane just hit New Orleans, and it's been a wild few weeks with LSU. So, and also, IU plays a top 25 matchup this week. So I'm thriving right now, T-Bob. How are you?
Yeah, congrats to Brody Miller. He was on my weekend winner segment of my radio show this morning. Indiana, now 2-0 on the year. Brody was born in 1994. We just established that before we started recording. And Indiana, for the first time since 1993, won a game as a ranked team. First time ever since Brody has been on this earth. Congratulations to you, Brody Miller. Now, y'all are top 15. You got to go kick Michigan's ass this weekend and let all of our LSU fans live vicariously through you.
I know we're going to get to the important stuff, but I have to actually like shout out. It's actually been really comical, like, in athletic comment section and whatnot, and usually we have a pretty active comment section. People are like commenting on LSU stories, being like, "Hey, thanks for the story about how bad the team is. By the way, congrats on the Hoosiers." It's been like a real thing happening. It's kind of entertaining. Like, I hate that I'm being linked as that. I don't want to seem like a homer, but I enjoy it. It's funny.
Yeah, dude. No, man. Just a little community in these dark times, right? Can't we all use a little bit of that?
Absolutely.
So,
for our listeners, you know, obviously later in the show, we are going to be joined by Bruce Feldman of The Athletic to talk about his awesome book on with Ed Ogeron, Flip the Script. Just a preview for that. But before that, we are going to talk a lot about everything that just happened this past week, which has been a lot of ugliness.
Well, look at you. I had forgotten about that. And here you did. You just completely hit it out of the park. Wow. Congrats, Brody.
Grizzled vet just, on the radio show.
You
yeah.
just got, I was about to say, you just like went up a belt. You are now a purple
what color?
Belt.
Yeah.
You're a purple belt. Well, no, thanks. I guess in this let's not get belt too system. Eager. Well, in this belt system, purple would probably actually be like really high
because
like
a good
LSU
point.
And yeah. everything. So you're green belt. Congrats.
Green belt sounds about right. I think
yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, that's perfect. All right. Let's dive into this game because it was anything but perfect. Brody, and I will open with this. I'm going to open with my view of how this game went down because anytime you're talking
this.
About a record-setting loss, which once again this was, unfortunately one of a record that I had a hand in was taken away here. We owned the largest margin of victory ever in this series from a 2011 game. Well, unfortunately now that has been surpassed with this 48-11 score. And so anytime you have, you know, when you lose in record-setting fashion, there is no one reason as to why that loss came back. Everybody has a role in it. I bring this up because I see many people bringing up TJ Finley's name as the reason for this loss. But as this pod will reveal, much like, you know, all of that win against South Carolina was not solely about TJ Finley, all of this loss is by no means solely about TJ Finley. In fact, I don't feel that it starts with TJ Finley. I feel that he was a symptom of some more core problems. And quite frankly, I mean, I think the easy catalyst starting point here is poor offensive line play. And I know that sounds cliche and it's almost easy to roll your eyes, but when you look at the chain reaction, you'll see what I mean. And it's not always a guarantee that poor offensive line play you can't overcome, because you can. Joe Burrow covered up a lot last year. Joe Burrow in the NFL on Sunday just beat a very good Titans team without a single original Bengals starter on that O-line. So, like, you can overcome this, but when you have true freshman quarterback, you cannot. So, bad O-line play, led to an inability to run the ball. A lot of times on first down. Put you in some bad spots on some third and longs, which then led to three and outs, which led to an inability to possess the ball, which helped to demoralize the defense after they were getting some of their only stops of the season. And then because you can't run the ball, the onus for success shifts from the running game, like it was against South Carolina, to T.J. Finley. What does that do to a freshman quarterback? It exposes him to more risk. I still love T.J. Finley. He actually did a lot of good things in this game that are buried under the bad, and I still love how he projects, but he is 18, and thus he will make 18-year-old mistakes. And so you have this pressure shifted to him. The mistakes get made. Those are then enough to break an already brittle defense, right? Or at least to push it to the breaking point. It's 14-0, and they've played their best game yet, and they're like, what's going on? And then next thing you know, after a couple punches, those turnovers, LSU's wobbling, they're wobbling, Auburn senses it, and they go for the 99-yard touchdown kill shot and completely shatter LSU. And at that point, this is a team that is already not very good, and when a team is not very good, they lack in confidence. And in that second half, their confidence was shattered, and sure enough, it opens up, 75-yard touchdown drive. Next play, T.J. Finley gets a ball batted up and picked, and at that point, LSU is officially dead. So you could almost call this game it's very much, this could be a book in Lemony Snicket's series of unfortunate events, because it just went south and it never stopped going that direction.
First off, I just got to give you a little like golf clap there, because I think you arguably just like broke down everything that went wrong in a game in a completely succinct fashion in like 2 minutes. So we might not even need a full pod. We'll figure it out as we go. But no, I think you completely nailed it, because, you know, I know, you know, based on Twitter and you even said on your rewatch that like it was really ugly. And of course it was ugly. It was the worst loss literally in LSU, not literally in LSU history, but the worst to an unranked team since the 30s, the worst loss in 25 years, and by context of what's going on. Like, it's a bad, all-time bad loss. And in the moment, I mean, my gamer that night was just tearing LSU to pieces for how embarrassing this was. But it's a weird game when you go back and rewatch it because of some of the things you just broke down. And on my second and third watch, I can't help but, you know, kind of pinpoint how it's a weird game, because for 25 minutes I didn't think particularly poorly of LSU and how they played.
No.
I really didn't, and that's what makes, because the defense is the part that when you look back on this game just in a grand scheme of things looks the worst, right? And gave up 5 consecutive touchdown drives, just looked embarrassed in the second half, that deserved the blame. But for 25 minutes it played the best 25 minutes it's played by, aside from Vanderbilt, which doesn't count, a drastic margin. I mean, they were making stops. They were making third down plays. The coverage actually looked really good for the most part for those 25 minutes. Everything looked solid. So I'm not going to blame them for kind of, you know, the dam's breaking at some point. So you look at that, and then you look at the offense, and even that's kind of tricky. Because first off, you're absolutely right. The O-line had its worst game of the season. Really troubling performance after by far its best performance. So then you don't even know what to make of it. Especially because it's not like South Carolina's front seven is actually much worse than Auburn's this year when you look at other performances. But anyway, getting sidetracked. And everything really stemmed from that O-line performance. You're absolutely right. But they still were moving the ball. And that's what's so weird. I think 6 of their first like 7 drives
I'll just jump in just one sentence
here. Yeah, please,
please. Because I think it reinforces your point. In my notes, I have it written that it's not that the O-line was spectacularly bad. Like, there were no just like, oh, this dude just got like dominated. Yeah. That wasn't happening consistently. There was no push. Like, when the ball was snapped, they were consistently a yard in the backfield, like down the line, compared to against South Carolina. It was just the complete and total opposite, where they were getting 1 to 2 yards of push on every snap.
No, I think that's a great way to break it down. I think that's a better way to put it. You're right. But, you know, like you're saying, they were depending on that O-line. So maybe it's unfair to, like, call them out specifically. But it was the focal point, like you're saying. But it's tricky, right? Because those, I think, I want to say it was 6 of the first 8 drives. They made it to at least around midfield or past midfield. They were getting first downs. They were actually beating Auburn in first downs, which isn't a perfect stat. But still, they were beating Auburn in first downs, like, for most of the first half. They were getting there, and they just couldn't capitalize, which obviously should be criticized for only scoring 3 points. I mean, no realm arguing the offense like played great, but they weren't inherently bad. And then something happened. It was obviously just that once the run game couldn't come, then, like you said, all the pressure fell on T.J. Finley, and they had to ask him to do too much. And all of a sudden, this guy who 2 weeks ago, you would have been thrilled with him completing 50% of his passes, had this weird amount of expectation on him that was completely false. And I actually want to get to that later. That it's actually, that's one of my most frustrating things about sports, and that TJ Finley is still a true freshman who just flat out wasn't ready to do that. And then eventually, you know, the hits started coming on him. And yeah, I think he got a little rattled. I'm not going to criticize him for it, you know. And it all just, but so when I leave this game, and I'm sorry, that was a long-winded way of getting around everything, but I don't leave that game thinking like LSU, at least in the first half, played awful. I think it was 21-3 at half, but in terms of if you just looked at it from, you know, your Bill Connelly win expectancy kind of stuff, where you look at a play-by-play basis, I don't know, Auburn was probably 7 points better that first half. You know, it wasn't anything drastic. What you really need to leave that game concerned about is that once things got pretty tough, that team just gave up. They collapsed. They just stopped caring. And maybe it looks like it's a disconnect with the coaching staff, at least on defense. It looks like some immaturity. It's probably a hybrid of a lot of things. But when you leave that game, your frustration should not be about much X's and O's, even though maybe a little Bo Pelini anger. But it really should be about, why did this team just give up in the second half and lose by 37 points?
Yeah, no, I think that's really well said in terms of like what your takeaway should be, because there are some interesting numbers. So to your point, when TJ Finley threw that pick, bro, did you know what his stats were? He was 7 of 10 for 80 yards. Like, that's
his job, and he also had two drops
situation. Yeah, exactly, right? That's what the Terrace Marshall drops or whatever. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a learning lesson for these guys in terms of mental toughness. I guess what makes it hard to judge, like, offensively, I'm okay with what I saw, because a lot of what you're talking about, there was still a lot of good that's buried under the overall bad, because, like, you did do some spectacular turnovers that really ended up just being way too impactful, even though they were only a single play. But there's still a lot of good offensively. It's, and I guess I still trust the overall scheme and kind of coaching staff on that side of the ball for the most part. It is tougher to feel too good about the defense just because the Pelini thing's just making everything awkward. Because it just looks kind of so out of touch on that side of the ball.
It does.
But yeah, and so they're definitely on a per play basis. They were not as bad as the final score would have you believe, but they folded and they showed no toughness. And part of that's being young. Part of that's like a leadership void. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to get anything better. I think there's one sequence that set up like a random, the 3rd and 6 on the fumble. Like, to me, that kind of told, if you look at that 4-down sequence, that kind of tells the whole story of the game as a whole, where on 1st and 10, Chasen Hines gets blown up, you're stopped for no gain, it's all of a sudden 2nd and 10. On 2nd and 10, I think it was like a little swing pass. You get 4 yards, try to get something more manageable. Not a bad job. Then you end up in 3rd and 6. Not where you want to be, and still because of the first round run, it's ultimately the first down run. It's why you ended up there. And then because it's 3rd and 6, you know, you want to throw the ball. You want to try to throw the first down, and Finley drops back. Everybody in the other line gets beat, and then you see Finley's kind of high school, his youth, come to the fore when he's just used to being way bigger than everyone. And so he just goes to, like, hold the ball up high, right? Like, I'm taller than everyone. I can just hold it up here, and I'll be fine. And that's, like, a classic, like, you can get away with it in high school, but it won't work on this level type of move. And that becomes a turnover and a touchdown for Auburn. But if you look at the sequence, right, it was some poor O-line play on a running play on first down. We've put them behind the chains, which set up a 3rd and long pass, which in the O-line lost their pass block. It exposes Finley's youth, which then leads to a big turnover and then a touchdown. And then after that, it did look like Finley was a bit rattled. The accuracy wavered a bit. The clock kind of sped up. And that was a wrap. And so it's – I guess, okay, so offensively, before we move on, because I want to get to the defense as well, what did you think about Max Johnson's play?
Well, yeah, and actually, I just want to say one last thing on TJ Finley, which is also just that, like you said, before that first pick, he was playing well. And by the way, not well, but he was just doing his job. He was doing what was asked of him, the same amount he was asked of him against South Carolina. You know, he just executed. He did the little things. And then he threw that pick, and by the way, you shouldn't even be mad at that pick. You know, he's a true freshman on the road for the first time and like 18 or 19 years old. You throw that pick, I think everybody collectively should be like, all right, it's about what you'd expect with a true freshman. Like, that should be factored into your game plan, right? To some weird extent. Like, all right, you're probably going to get a true freshman pick. That should be, or else you're not planning right. It didn't even look bad after that necessarily. You know, I think the next drive, they had a nice little drive to the 43 that just stalled. You know, it's not like he collapsed after that. And I don't even have a point here. It was just kind of that until the fumble, I don't really think I had much anger with TJ Finley. Anger is not the right word.
For sure.
And the other thing I want to say is...
Well, you didn't think he was playing poorly. Like, the fumble was his clearest mistake. Like, the pick was not nearly as much of a mistake as holding the ball above your head like on the fumble.
And then, like you said, right after that, you started seeing him maybe scurry a little bit quicker in the pocket, or his accuracy dipped a little because he got a little jumpier. The last thing I want to say about this is just, and it kind of gets to the point I was making earlier, which is the frame of expectation in sports is almost the most frustrating thing about it sometimes, but also what gives us people like us jobs, is that TJ Finley, I actually feel zero difference in how I look at TJ Finley after Saturday's performance that I did 2 weeks ago. Actually, I probably think higher of him than I did before that South Carolina game, because I think everybody, and I know I touched on this, but everybody started proclaiming him like the guy who should be above Miles Brennan after that South Carolina game. And I mean, I'm sure you had it in your mentions as well. Like, it wasn't like small. It was a legitimate like chunk of this fan base that was, I'm not saying all, but maybe 30-40% that genuinely thought it should be a no-brainer. Finley's the guy.
Yeah.
I actually got in a little small, like playful debate on Andy Staples' show last week about how he thought it should be Finley, you know, and I just kind of said, like, guys, I think if Miles Brennan was given that same exact game plan with that same running play, he would have also executed those 8-yard slants all day. Like, so I still was impressed with everything I saw from TJ Finley against South Carolina, and then but I never left that game thinking this guy is ready to be a starter in the SEC. I just didn't. So nothing about this Saturday really made him look worse or better to me. I think it was still just about what I'd expect. He still looks like a pretty promising freshman who probably can do some things and just has to go through some growing pains, and that's fine. And I know that's I'm on a tangent. I just kind of wanted to like
no,
put that
I
out
think
there.
You're absolutely right though, and I think that's important to talk about. Now I think also if you're a loyal Hold the podcast listener, I hope that's a takeaway that you came from with, you know, from the last podcast, because I feel like we did a pretty good job of kind of establishing that being the case. I mean, I think I'm even more bullish on TJ Finley than you are.
I'd still give him like a, I think he is a definition of a good SEC backup. That's a compliment. He's a very solid SEC backup.
But you mean like where he's at currently in his career?
Absolutely, yeah. He is on the right path. Yeah,
I'm just saying that I still think that, like, you know, in terms of trajectory and thinking what he can be, I mean, I'm still thinking this dude could be a beast. Now, Ogeron, in his press conference today, did say that by no means is the quarterback competition wrapped up, that it is still an open competition, that if, you know, if Max Johnson is to practice better this week, then he would get the start. And I think that's the right thing in this situation. I think you want to keep both these guys as motivated as possible, as locked in as possible. So let's talk about Max Johnson.
I didn't actually answer your question.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. But what did you think about what you saw out of Johnson, which is, you know, a weird time of the game to try to judge when he goes in, but in that second half.
Yeah, I'm not coming away with any grand takeaways because, like you said, it was 35-3 when he entered the game. But I come away with it, you know, I think what I saw from, I don't know, 20 minutes of Max Johnson was about also how I feel after six quarters of TJ Finley. I think it's in the same realm. You know, I don't think that is a, and I don't mean that as a dig. I mean that as a general, like, both those guys look like they can be perfectly solid replacement level backups, you know, where Max Johnson, for the most part, he seemed in rhythm. You know, I mean, granted, they weren't playing aggressive defense, but he seemed in rhythm, completed his passes. I think the big takeaway was the exact same thing we had heard before, that he had some nice legs and that, well, okay, watch, that came out weird. But, you know, is pretty mobile. And that's one of those things we kept hearing, but it was actually impressive to watch when, like, a pocket would collapse and there's three Auburn, you know, guys in the front seven right in his face, and he could back away and run around in a circle and actually beat them all around and get to at least the line of scrimmage. That was actually like, okay, he actually does have a, you know, pretty mobile body. And then, yeah, and then you look at that deep ball to Kayshon Booty. It was genuinely a nice throw. So I don't leave that game thinking he's better than TJ Finley or worse than TJ Finley, but he looked pretty solid in his first real playing time. So I kind of go into this week thinking it should be pretty even, and we'll see who comes out ahead in the next 10 days.
Yeah, I think it's well said. I think it's well said to both those guys. I mean, I have nothing to add on Max Johnson. The touchdown was tight. It was cool. I liked seeing Kayshon Boutte get a deep ball as well. That was nice, even though it happened when it didn't matter.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's
the
little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Other offensive thoughts that I have to wrap up, Arik Gilbert needs more touches.
Yeah.
There is no way that the large tight end from Auburn should have more touches than Arik Gilbert. Why does that guy get touches? They scheme him touches. Start scheming and calling more stuff for Gilbert. It's crazy that he didn't get more touches.
I would agree.
John Emery needs all of the running back touches until he's too tired to go for a series. And I've been very hesitant to come over to this side of the conversation. Ooh. But when your O-line isn't getting push, it is clear that he gives you the greatest chance of making something out of nothing.
Okay, I'd agree with that.
I mean, there's the play in the first quarter. He breaks the tackle, reverses the field, 5-yard gain, one in following the fumble where I think he got a first down, hitting like a nice spin move in the hole when he should have been tackled for nothing. And then obviously Curry had the big drops when you were looking to get a little something going. And just Curry and then TDP to a lesser extent just don't bring the dynamism. Like I said, when things aren't going well in terms of being able to create, Emery needed to be in that game more. And I think that's probably all. I think I made my thoughts clear in the O-line. I don't think Jason Hines played very well.
I was going to say, because we didn't really point anyone out. I think it's Jason Hines had a rough day. Cam Wire had a below average day. The rest, I don't really, like you said, I don't think I felt like they were terrible. They just didn't really, like, excel.
Shanahan gets driven back still a little bit too much, but he's just dealing with physical limitations. That's just going to be who he is. He does a good job of operating within kind of his skill set.
You know who he is? He's 2018 Lloyd Cushenberry. 2018 Lloyd Cushenberry never blew anyone away. He just did his job and hung in there. And then 2019 Cushenberry happened to like become way stronger and more athletic and like look like a stud. But anyway, sorry, weird tangent.
Yeah, so we'll see. And another guy that could actually return now with COVID if you could re-recruit him, which would be interesting to kind of keep an eye on. And then, just the whole line kind of got pushed around a bit. How do you feel about LSU continuing the zone runs on third and short, like the tipo zone runs? Because I don't know if I fully believe this or not, or if this was written in a time of passion. But look, they're not even running zone read anymore, right? Because the quarterback's not going to pull it. So they're blocking the backside defensive end. So already you've lost kind of a lot of the advantage that you had in last year, where the real threat was it could go to Clyde or Burrow would keep it. I also feel that I don't think the personnel is well suited to it. I don't think the tempo is crisp enough when you're doing it. So I don't think you're actually threatening anybody with your speed. And so if you're not like executing it, you're not surprising people with it and it's not fast enough. I just kind of feel like it's a little slow and predictable right now. And I know it worked, I think, once maybe this game, maybe twice. But like I'm not sure if this is as a coach where you just maybe have to like accept that you gotta change some of your playbook to fit your personnel and that it just isn't cutting it anymore. I don't know if I'm fully there yet, but that's just I'm just floating that out there.
No, I mean, I'm not going to add a ton. I think I'm with you mainly on the fact that it needs to be a zone read in some sense. And I remember even being told by some people in the program that like week one, you know, where people were kind of frustrated at Brennan, like you're saying, they kept blocking the end. And then I was told they actually did adjust it after week one where Brennan did have the option to pull, but it doesn't look like I've seen that. But my takeaway just on what you're saying is it seems like I think LSU sometimes has an outdated view of things where it's like, we're LSU, we should be able to get 3 yards on a run on third down. I think they just have that mentality of like, well, if we can't do that, what are we doing? You know, I think that's it's unfortunate. And also, it's probably a little tough for an OC to be like, 3rd and 3 in a close game, I'm going to turn to my freshman quarterback. That's probably just a little hard. But I'm still with you on almost every point, so no real extra thought there.
Yeah, there's two sides to every decision. You got to try to weigh everything.
Context guy.
I think I want a little more. Yeah, context king, exactly. I think I do want a little more. I feel like I don't know what I want out of Linehan. I guess I wanted to see some more evolution, right? Like I wanted to see a lot of last year's offense, but with things built on top of it. Maybe that's not a fair ask now that you're in the freshman quarterback era. And so, you know what? I'll hold off. We'll see. Because of that, I'll hold off. Okay, defensively.
Let's do some defense. Yeah.
Like we said, solid start to the game. I think that Micah Baskerville, while not great, is a market improvement over Damone Clark. If nothing else, he was decisive a lot of times. He was aggressive. He was trying to dictate, trying to meet people at the line. Wasn't always successful, but was more successful than you had been. Brody.
I want to jump in. Yeah,
go ahead. Go for it.
I think that's the Micah Baskerville thing is a real thing, and I think it almost – that's the Baskerville versus Clark is when you look at, like, hey, why was this defense better? I think you can just literally point to that, and it's not the defense and it's almost like in a symbolic way and a literal way in the sense that the defense didn't look great. The defense didn't look astounding or anything, but they just kind of, at least that first 25 minutes, were just kind of where they were supposed to be. They might have got pushed back a little, but, you know, they'd make the tackle, that kind of thing. And that is also the literal difference between Baskerville and Clark, which was that the Clark problem, we know Clark is a physical freak. I mean, I can't even overstate how good, you know, Damone Clark is when he knows what he's doing. We've seen it at times. But he just is flat out not in the right place a lot. He over pursues. Yeah. He isn't even getting in front of an offensive player. You know what I mean? Baskerville does not have his physical tools. But he was, for the most part, pretty much just like you were saying, he was meeting guys at the line. He was just always where he was supposed to be. And in turn, he might have gotten 2 yards of forward progress or something like that because he just isn't that kind of talent. But he was just there, you know, and he'd get the tackle or help out and whatnot. And that was the difference between, you know, 20-yard runs where no one touches him for 15 yards and, you know, a 6-yard gain that sets up a third down. And I really think that's just kind of what I point to when I look at the difference.
No, I mean, I think you're right. And I think that I don't know if maybe the defensive frustration has grown so much that I'm just like nitpicking at this point. But
do it.
It just makes you question, like, what have the coaches been watching, right? to say the comments that you said about the defense in the offseason, to hand out the 18s and the 7 to who you handed them to start Damone Clark over Micah Baskerville for that long when, as you said, the results, it was clearly better with the latter. It just makes you question what exactly is going on in the evaluation process.
By the way, I have to say, man, I don't think I've ever heard you just have this kind of tone on a podcast or a radio show before. It's fascinating. It's normally you are just energy, 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 and right now you are just kind of like, I don't know what they're watching. Well, it's tough to hear, brother.
If you spend enough time watching this LSU defense, this is just how you come out the other side.
Two kids might have an impact too.
But. I think that's probably two. Even though, I mean, daylight savings is huge. It's been awesome. I'm super into it. That said, I think I gave this defense too much credit for simplifying last week against South Carolina. I don't know if it was, you know, they cut down the mental mistakes, but I now feel that had nothing to do with LSU and everything to do with South Carolina's offense being so bland.
I would agree.
Challenge you in any way, because any pre-snap motion that I saw this game, again, looked like someone threw a grenade into the LSU backfield. I don't know how they're teaching it, but my God, jet sweep motion just blows LSU's mind. You would think they've never defended a jet sweep before because they never get it right in terms of who has the ball, who doesn't have the ball, and the way that they're able to be influenced. It's kind of wild considering the jet sweep's been like such an established part of football for years now, and they just look like they've never seen it before.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're at five games now where it's just a consistent theme. And you know, when you pinpoint would look bad with the defense against Auburn, it's pretty much, I don't think that much actually looked that, like, horrendous, but the one theme that has continued to look terrible was, one, an ability to, like you said, just handle motions, jet sweeps, those kind of things, and two, connected to that, just set any kind of edge, get any kind of contain. And I think there are very explicable reasons for that, but it's just kind of, it's shocking that you're at this point now where you still just can't defend that when you know now the film's out on you, that's all anyone's probably going to run if they're smart, because, you know, you were actually giving them credit after the South Carolina game defensively, and I know they held them to 23, so it looked better, but they still gave up like 8 yards of play. I thought it was a terrible performance against South Carolina still in a lot of ways. And the play that jumps out, you know, this game, you know, we're talking about these motions and whatnot, was, and I'm sure this is the one you're thinking of, the play where I think it was either Stove or Schwartz, you know, goes in motion halfway, so then Cordell Flott's chasing him across the field, and then he cuts back and goes the other way, and they basically just dump off to him in the flat, and Flott's like 20 yards behind him now because he wasn't ready for that. Nobody else was in that realm. It was just kind of the perfect highlight of, like, they're just not ready for this, and these aren't that forward thinking of things.
No, they have no idea what's going on. I mean, there's the touchdown following the interception where Auburn gets a penalty, and all of a sudden it's first and goal in the 9. You're like, ooh, is Auburn about to, like, maybe screw this up? And then they pull one little shift, and at the snap, Damone Clark or Jabril Cox, remember which one it is turned around talking to the safety. Eli Ricks is running field side to the short side, like sprinting across the field. And then as soon as the ball is snapped, all the action goes to exactly where Eli Ricks just vacated. And they score a touchdown. Like, it's just so wild still how many guys are talking or not set on the defensive front when these motions are going down.
And
do you have anything to add there?
Well, I think the other thing to add, because remember I was saying, like, the reasons they're getting beat on the edge is, you know, first off, confusion. I think that's the first thing. But it's also explicable in the sense that, listen, I actually can defend this to some small extent. The reason they never can set an edge, and partially, is because their defensive ends, which have also, by the way, been like a highlight of the team, are, you know, 230-pound edge rushers. That's what they are. You know, that is who, that's what they make their bread and butter on. And you play two of them. And by the way, pass rush has been the strength. So you can't be, you have to make your own decision as a fan or a coach or anyone. Would you make that trade-off? Would you be okay with, you know, them getting that those edge rushers getting a few sacks a game but never being able to get contained? Or would you rather put, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example, but like a Glenn Logan at the defensive end or something, and sacrifice that pass rush? That's what you have to ask yourself. But right now, those guys are just constantly getting beat on the edge.
And that's where Ollie Gay just
Ollie needs Gay's to be better just against a really the run. Tough time. Yeah. Because that's not even a strength thing, by the way. That one is him just over-pursuing or just like not being able to make a tackle in open field.
Yeah, because, I mean, I have it here in my notes. Ollie Gay still looks huge,
big guy,
tight. Like, he looks gigantic still. But you would expect to be that big that he'd be a little firmer on the edge. So, yeah, I it's just the whole team. I mean, I yell about contain the entire week, and then they just lose contain. Something that disappoints me, Brody, I have almost no thoughts on the defensive line, because nobody ever flashes on the defensive line.
And I, first off, 100% right. We're several games in, and I know Joseph Evans had like one good game earlier. But yeah, they're just at a point where they're not creating any havoc, which is the number one thing they were like supposed to be able to do in this 4-3 scheme. And I think I actually highlight them when I look at that second half where the team just felt like I hate to get dramatic, but kind of gave up. That defensive tackle was one of the main areas where I felt like I saw it. Where I don't even know if there's anyone in particular that I really want to like call out there, but yeah, it just seemed like sometimes they were just putting their body and just like okay with getting pushed 4 yards back, and they just like were kind of giving their body up and didn't really care anymore. And I think that's defensive tackle jumps out there. So yeah, I think that's the D line is kind of where I jump to when I look at what fell apart.
Yeah, and in the end, well, real quick on special teams, Von Rosenberg's playing the ball really well. I wish that execution would have been a bit better. I wish they would have gone for the one that they punted that they didn't down that ended up being like a net like 26-yard gain. I don't think LSU should be making any decisions this year based on their defense having success. Like, I don't care how your defense has played to that point. You cannot make a decision being like, yeah, I'm sure the defense will hold them.
Yeah, I guess devil's advocate, you just have to be like, hey, it's a 0-0 game. Are we going to be like, is this missed call going to turn the tide? But no, I think that's the opposite of you.
Because
it ended up turning the tide, yeah.
Well, also, like, yeah, you know that the analytics say, no, or not the analytics, but like whatever, the accepted theory there would be that, no, if, you know, if you're going to make these decisions, you have to make them all the time, right? And so I don't care if LSU's defense is on a heater for a quarter, they will break eventually.
By the way, LSU is number one in the country in a special teams SP plus ranking. Just food for thought.
What's good?
People Cade forget.
Cade York's a beast. That's all else I was going to say. I still like Cade York. Yep. NFL kickers make 50-yard kicks at a 1-2 clip, so it makes sense what we saw. All right, Brody. Wrapping up the pod here. I do not think I'm going to pick LSU to win another game this year. They're too young. I'm not saying they won't win another game, but like I will never again going into a game. Maybe let's see where like Arkansas.
I think they'll be. I feel confident they'll beat Arkansas. I do.
Well, yeah, I want to see where they're at the time, right? But from here, it's just I don't know that I'm ever going to, because I actually backed LSU pretty hard going into this Auburn matchup. I really liked it. I thought won the line battle against South Carolina, they could replicate that. But it looks like they're just too young. They're too volatile. They'll still get it together for, I think, at least two Saturdays and look really good a couple times. Be like, oh, like you said, like a trust the process game. Like, look, they will be good eventually. But for the most part, I think it is what it is, and it's just going to be a very poor year.
Yeah. No, I mean, that last thing I'll say before we go out is just I love highlighting SP Plus's, you know, odds of finishing with X amount of wins. And right now, 3 wins is 33%, 4 wins is 38%, 5 wins is 17%. So they are more—they are twice as likely to go 3-7 as they are to go 5-5, which is just a mind-boggling thought. And I think that's a perfect way to go into our interview with Bruce Feldman.
Yeah, it's crazy how much can change in so short a time. But look, I do think if you can weather this storm, we got to touch on this with Bruce, there is hope for the future. So stick around. Hold That Podcast. Bruce Feldman coming up next.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey, welcome back, HTPP listeners. Right now, me and Brody are joined by our good friend, Bruce Feldman, who also works over at The Athletic, at Bruce Feldman CFB. On Twitter, he is the writer of multiple very good football books. He is a New York Times bestselling author. I feature in one of them, Meat Market, in which you can hear about Drake Nevis dominating to the point of tears, I believe it is. And now he has another book called Flip the Script, in which he was embedded essentially with Coach O during this incredible national championship 15-0 run last year. And who better to talk to about where LSU goes from here than the man who, as I said, has been with Coach O during all this process, Bruce Feldman. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Good to be on with you guys. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so I guess there's so many different directions that we could go here to begin with, but let's start very basic. I guess kind of give the listeners the process of writing this book and exactly what this book is in your eyes.
Okay. So as you mentioned, Meat Market, which, hey, I still remember going to Great Atlanta Christian to see you because you were high on the Ole Miss Rebels list back in the day. Coach O was a central figure in that. And obviously he was a larger than life character, and it was a roller coaster ride. And the book did well. It did, I think, better than a lot of people, including myself, thought it would do, to the point where for years I would get asked, are you ever going to do a sequel to that? And I just didn't think that I would, because I didn't think it, you know, just to have that kind of process would have taken a lot, and it just kind of backburned in my back of my head. And then I'd obviously followed Ogeron's career, especially when he was out here in California as USC interim head coach. And then back probably about 18 months ago, we were talking, he was raving about the new young offensive coach he'd added to the staff. And obviously that was Joe Brady. And I went down in April of 2019 and spent a week there and went to meetings, and I was at spring practice and spent some time around Joe, and came away thinking, wow, they're really onto something and this is going to be different. And yeah, I know I've heard this before about LSU's offense, but man, they are, the offense is kicking the defense's butt and everything. And it just, I didn't know they would win a national title, but that's when I started really working on the book proposal, which I saw as the sequel to Meat Market, and kept on working on it. And then when they beat Alabama, I was actually, my TV crew was actually in Oklahoma for an Oklahoma game. And I watched most of that game with actually Barrett Jones, who was also doing the game for the radio broadcast, former Alabama offensive lineman. I came away, was like, all right, this is a, I got to do this book. Because I knew Ed's story, and Ed's story especially, and this is bigger than, obviously this framed around the 2019 national title season, but really when you think about it, you guys know this from covering him, and obviously T-Bob, you know it well from being so connected to him for so long with your family connection. There's no coach in any level of football who has experienced the highest of highs as he has, but also the lowest and the depths of the lows. And that story arc is pretty amazing to me, and so improbable, just when you think of not just getting fired and the, like a spectacular flame out at Ole Miss after 3 years, but really, you know, he's a young assistant in his 20s at Miami on Jimmy Johnson's staff. He's coaching great players. It's Russell Merrill and Cortez Kenny and later Warren Sapp. But he realizes he cannot handle alcohol. He ends up in a real battle with addiction, and a lot of the lessons that he's learned, and now he's sober 20 years, but a lot of lessons he learned in that, I think were very relevant to his evolution as a coach and as a person. And so all those things kind of, I think, you know, I think the book to me was about learning from your mistakes, and as he has, not just learning from the mistakes he made at Ole Miss, but then being Lane's right-hand man at Tennessee and then at USC, and learning from Lane's mistakes, and then getting on at LSU and learning from Les's mistakes. And so I think there's a real evolution to where he's at. And now, you know, look, flip the script, and now all of a sudden they got to flip the script because almost all their starters from last year's national title team are gone, whether they're in the NFL or they opted out. Joe Brady's gone. Dave Aranda's gone. And you're seeing they're digging out of a hole right now and see how quickly they can rebuild it.
And I think T-Bob and I are both going to get to this year eventually. But, I mean, one thing I'm always fascinated to ask you is, I mean, you've like you said, you've known him a long time. And so much of, you know, when you wrote Meat Market or, you know, throughout his whole career, it's more of a guy, an underdog guy, you know, coming up, dealing with issues in Miami, dealing with issues at Ole Miss and USC, and a guy, like, fighting to finally reach the mountaintop. So what was it – I guess my question is, now you worked on a book with him – post-national championship or during national championship. And it's just, I imagine this guy who finally reached his life dream, right? So how have you seen him change in the, you know, 10, 15, 20 years you've known him when you were writing the book with him this spring?
Well, I think one of the big things, Brody, to me was him having the self-awareness. And again, I think this probably comes from a big part of the battles of, you know, learning the lessons he's had to learn from, you know, from the bigger picture stuff he's had to deal with. But I think it's okay, the instincts and the impulses he still has, they don't go away because of your evolution and what you've learned. But it's like, there's a part of the book and where he talks about after they beat Alabama, there's a player on the team who, there's a video that comes out of the post-game locker room celebration. And Ogeron's kind of awareness to say, hey, the old me would have handled it this way. And that wouldn't have worked out. That wouldn't have been optimum. Because that would have only prolonged it and kind of made it worse. And so he has enough awareness to go, yeah, old me or old Miss version of me would have done this. I know I can't do it that way, or I know I shouldn't do it that way. And I think those are the things that when you hear him articulate, I mean, even after they win the national title, he's on the podium, and we had this conversation about just kind of what's going through your head on that. And on one hand, he admits that, man, you know, he's won national championships before. He certainly, you know, won a couple at Miami and then won a couple at USC. But those were when Pete Carroll was the head coach, or those were when Jimmy Johnson or Dennis Erickson was the head coach. And it does feel a little differently when it's the team, you know, that you helped build, when it's the staff you helped build. It had more of an investment, but more of a hand in it. And yet at the same time, when you start thinking about vindication, because I had kind of, you know, reached in on this about him and asked him, you know, because a lot of people were like, he has no business being the head coach at LSU. He's not the right guy to lead them. And all those other things of, you know, columns that were written, you know, 5 years ago or 4 or 5 years ago, or people who mocked him, you know, back when he was at Ole Miss. And he said, I'm not going to let myself think that way because I know that does not do me any good. It's like just not healthy to go there. And even in that moment where it would be totally understandable if you let yourself go there, he kind of had the awareness to pull back and go, I'm not doing it. It's just not healthy. And, you know, I give him credit for that because I think it's human nature to do that. I know that I don't live those emotions the way he does, but I could understand it if he did it and he, you know, chose not to.
Yeah, I call my high school teachers who told me I wouldn't be good every day just to let them know. So I'm with you. I don't know how I would handle it well.
Bruce, how about, so, I mean, obviously, just from hearing you speak on this, like, I think you have very good insight into Coach O, the process that he's established, things like the one team, one heartbeat, LSU standard performance. And so, through what you know about him and his past and this turnaround, this come up, I guess what's your view on where currently LSU finds himself this season at 2-3, and some real struggles along the way, kind of beyond what anybody would have expected.
Yeah, you know, I see a lot of parallels between this team and the one in 2017. And I think, now, first of all, obviously, that one, there's a pandemic, so the offseason is completely different, obviously, and everything around it is completely different. But I think when you look at that, and again, it was different for me, and I think Brody and I had this conversation offline a while, you know, a couple months ago or so about, I had mentioned to him, it's covered in the and flip the script about this, you know, really impactful speech that Duke Riley made coming back to the team as a NFL rookie and being around them on a bye week and just seeing things being disgusted and calling these guys out. But, you know, in that moment, like, first of all, the parallels here, you know, that team was Ogeron's first full, you know, he's no longer like the guy who took over for Les Miles. He's got the job. It's his first full year as the head coach. He couldn't get Lane Kiffin because Lane ended up as the FAU head coach. But instead, you know, he turns and hires Matt Canada. Look, Matt Canada's had success at a bunch of places, but it was just a bad fit. It was a bad fit from almost the start of when he gets there. And so there's a lot of rocky moments. They get blown out at Mississippi State. I mean, that game was every bit as ugly as this one this past weekend at Auburn. And then they have a bad loss to Troy. Look, and that was, I remember watching that game. It wasn't like anything fluky. Troy just beat them, you know, right? Yeah. So it's like you lost to Troy at home. Oh, my God. And in there, in the middle of there, there was also like a bad Syracuse team that gave them all they could handle, right? So they were reeling. Now, I think what is different about that team than this team, I think they have some more established players on that group than this one did. So I think, whereas here you have Terrace Marshall, who's you know, been terrific. But I think, you know, you're right now they're playing true freshman quarterbacks, right? And so I just think they're really got to sort out a lot of stuff. Obviously, the Bo Pelini hire is really shaky the way it's looking right now. I mean, the communication is lacking. They're giving up tons of big plays. I mean, I had this discussion with Stu on the Audible this week. You know, it was like Dave Aranda was gone. It wasn't like you're going to keep a guy from a Big 12 head coaching job, but it's like, you know, Ed grew up coaching wise in Jimmy Johnson's defense and then in Pete Carroll's defense. And Bo Pelini has connection to Pete Carroll. I mean, he coached under him. And that is a version of the scheme he's more comfortable with than the three-man front. And I think the three-man front obviously gives him more flexibility to stop the run. But I think there's a lot of other challenges that have come with this. And the players clearly are struggling with all the checks and different adjustments. And it's been bad. And I think that's the thing is when you look at this team, just on the outside, you're like, okay, they still have what we think is the best defensive back in the country in Derek Stingley. You know, that should be, you know, that should be at least one spot locked down. But at the same time, you're just seeing, I don't know. I mean, one play jumped out at me over the weekend where it's like third and seven, or I think, or, you know, roughly like a third and medium to third and long. And Bo Nix hits an easy pass. And I'm looking, I'm like, Cordell Flott is like 6 yards away from the guy. And he's like the nearest one. I'm like, how is it that easy? Right. Something is wrong. Right. And so it's not just the big plays. It's all those other things. And I just feel like right now you're seeing a team that is reeling. Like they were hanging around and competitive. Yeah. And then once TJ Finley like overthrows a receiver and it's basically a pick six, and then there's the fumble where he doesn't protect the ball. I think you just saw a true freshman quarterback who, as Brody wrote last week, was in a scaled down offense and executed it really well and looked like he was playing with a ton of confidence. Then all of a sudden got a real snapshot of what life in the SEC is going to be like. And he did not look like he was ready for that. Like it was like the first week, I don't know. It was one of those where he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And then the second week it was like, oh boy. And you know, that's what right now, I mean, buckle up, because when you look at the rest of the schedule, Arkansas is much better than they have been in the last few years. That's, you know, that's not a cupcake win, and Ole Miss can score points on anybody. And that's going to be a battle. I mean, it's going to be a struggle to get to 4 or 5 wins. It's going to be a huge struggle to do that for this team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if they'll be favored in a game this year, but you do hit on a few kind of fascinating points that I see about this LSU program, which are like, yeah, the short term looks kind of horrifying, like especially from what LSU fans are used to. But the long term still is a very interesting projection when you think about all the young kids that you're playing this year, how that tends to pay dividends to maybe even 3 years down the road. The idea of how many guys can you keep around even longer because this year everybody gets into the year of eligibility. Like, and then just whatever, the recruiting, right? Another 5-star in the boat on Saturday. So it's like, if you can weather this kind of storm, you maybe can still get, you know, long-term still predict to be pretty damn good. I guess from your perspective, what you know about Coach O, what makes him or doesn't make him well-suited to weathering the storm and kind of getting to that kind of that promised land on the opposite side?
Well, I think what suits him probably best is three things. The first thing is he's been there and he's had to, you know, he's built it. Like what's really different between now and 2017? And look, 2017 ended up as a top 25 team. They were 18th. So this team is not going to, even in best case scenario, they're not getting there, right? You know, you'd have to be foolish to think that they're going to bounce back that way. But I think in 2017, you know, he had done a really good job as an interim head coach twice, but nobody was going to buy that he was going to lead them to an SEC title, much less a national championship. Well, he is a national championship coach. I mean, you can say that was Joe Burrow or Joe Brady, and yes, they deserve a ton of credit, but let's remember, like, Ohio State didn't want Joe Burrow, and nobody knew who Joe Brady was. So, I mean, you know, he was the one who found those guys and built that you know, there's a lot of these guys who were, you know, 2-star Justin Jefferson, 3-star Clyde. I mean, a lot of these pieces came together as they did, and maybe it's somewhat catching lightning in a bottle, but I mean, he's a really, really good evaluator of talent. It's kind of not shocking that the same weekend they have a really bad loss, they also get a 5-star at a position they desperately need, right? They need a really, really good safety in the middle of the defense who they can lean on, right? And so I think, like, as you said, I mean, they have a lot of – when they blew out South Carolina, the three of the best players they had on the field were obviously Finley. Then you're having B.J. Ojulari have 3 sacks and be SEC Defensive Player of the Week. And you have Elias Ricks have a pick 6 and be pretty strong at corner. And those are all true freshmen. And when you have a tight end,
is Avery Gilbert catching?
Yeah, exactly. When you have a tight end like that, who's an absolute matchup nightmare. I mean, there's a lot of things that I think not too far down the road bode well. But right now, I mean, I don't know who they look at and go, like, with once Jamar Chase left, I think Jamar Chase was the big security blanket because it was like, okay,
yeah,
like, no doubt. When things were a little like, not they were on the ropes against Clemson, but when they were down 10 points, oh, Jamar Chase is going to take their best defensive back and abuse him. And he's going to, you know, take over the game. And he's going to be the thing that kind of gets it. And you still had, obviously, Joe Burrow there that like, you know, would carry it. Right now, I don't know who they look at. It's hard to look at a corner, even if it's Deion Sanders, and say, okay, he's gonna carry us in this game. And that, you know, you don't see that in their front seven of any of those guys. I'm not saying, you know, Ojulari is not an impressive young player, or, you know, you see Jabril Cox is making some plays, but right now they look like a team that is playing with a lot of guys who are probably a year away from being like the guys who should be carrying a team. They just, I don't know where you look at and say, okay, this is something we know we can count on. And that's a hard place to be, especially when you're on the road, especially when you're kind of reeling. But I think the recruiting piece of this is big. Now, I don't know what the adjustments are going to happen after this year, because I suspect they will have a couple of other South Carolina-like performances where things will look better. I don't expect it to obviously happen against Alabama, but, you know, I think they have enough talent where they're going to be guys who are going to make big plays. And then the question is going to be, like, right now, this team, if things aren't going very well, it has the risk for the bottom to drop out in the game, which was exactly what we saw against Auburn, right? Like, they were hanging around, it was competitive, and then all of a sudden it was like 2 bad plays happened and they didn't have enough within them to turn it around.
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly what we've been talking about on today's pod as well. They just cratered so fast. So we'll see. It's kind of interesting, the lead characters who tend to emerge in these situations. Back in 2017, it was Devin White. I certainly don't see anybody like that here, but only time will tell. Bruce, you cannot thank you enough for coming on today. Always a pleasure to talk to you, man. Check out the new book, everybody. Flip the Script. Available everywhere.
Available everywhere. Just go to Amazon and Google Flip the Script, or you can find it on top of my Twitter profile. There's a link right to it.
There you go. Check out Bruce's work in The Athletic, and it's at Bruce Feldman CFB on Twitter. We'll be back with more Hold the Podcast.
All right, and a huge thank you to Bruce Feldman for stopping by the Hold That Podcast. The book is Flip the Script. Check it out, LSU fans. Trust me, you'll love it. Also, may have some nuggets for why you should remain hopeful that LSU can pull out of this tailspin long-term. Short-term, Brody, the schedule does not look great right now. LSU just got done with the kind of easy part of their schedule, you could say, is it year 2 and 3, and it's official. I will not be picking them to win another game. Maybe save like Arkansas, Ole Miss, we'll see where they're at. But just when you look at the schedule, this team is too young, they're too volatile, too inconsistent. I don't feel that I can give them the benefit of the doubt in any of these situations anymore.
Well, first off, yeah, I think they've lost all benefit of the doubt going forward. Because, I mean, I think with each week, you know, with maybe the exception of South Carolina, I feel like each week I come away, or at least with each loss, I come away thinking things are like the connection is more lost between the staff and the players and just the culture. I think it's like getting worse and worse. And granted, yeah, really good time for a bye week. Maybe sometimes these things can, you know, get figured out a little bit, maybe possible. But like you said, they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt right now. I probably will still pick them against Arkansas. But what makes this all tricky, and it goes back to the benefit of the doubt thing, is that I still think, like, if they just play to even like 60% of just what their talent level is, if they can just eliminate the stupidity and just kind of play average football, yeah, they should beat Arkansas. And then, yeah, they should actually still beat Ole Miss, you know, yeah. But they've lost that benefit of the doubt that you should ever assume that. Because that's also how I felt about the Auburn game. I said, if LSU can actually just play decent O-line play, if they can eliminate the 50-yard plays, which, by the way, they did for the most part, they can win. And they just didn't do those things. You know, they still had those issues. So, yeah, they've lost that. And you're going to lose to Bama by, I mean, God, they could put up 70 on them. You're going to lose. I mean, A&M, I think, is – I feel very vindicated. But A&M, I think, is just a consensus very good football team. I don't think they're, like, top five or anything. Oh, my God.
If you start victory lapping for A&M, Brody.
I'm not victory lapping, but I think they're going to beat LSU.
The podcast.
At Kyle Field with, you know, one of the few teams actually bringing a full crowd. I think, you know, Texas A&M should win that game pretty handily. And, yeah, I think Florida is still going to rout LSU. So you just got to hope. I mean, because if you can get to – 4-6 is still terrible, but 4-6, you at least have some self-respect. I think,
dude, 4-6 sounds a lot better than 3-7. And regardless of how sad you think that is, that's the reality of where you're at right now.
And hey, I mean, I'll say this though, I think we have to shout out just like for a quick second how important that Sage Ryan recruiting win is, because that could have been, man, that could have been like a poster moment for, oh shit, things are slipping away from Ed Ogeron LSU. It could have been. I mean, that would have been dramatic. They still had a top five class, all that stuff. But it could have been one of those things where it's like, oh shoot, you're losing all these games. Things are getting further and further away. And you just lost your in-state guy who was an absolute lock for most of this year. That would have been like a real it's falling apart moment. So being able to, and just, you know, for most of you don't know, yeah, they pretty much, as of Tuesday, he was a guaranteed to Bama, and then also you came back in the last second and flipped it, which credit to them. That's a huge win for them. And because you just have to land. This recruiting class is in some ways one of the most important, you know, because if you have to be able to say, hey, I have three top five recruiting classes in a row and you still have the talent and you can maybe push forward, this can just be an off year.
Yeah. I hope that's the case, but yes, it definitely felt like Sage Ryan as an 18-year-old collectively saved the consciousness of the LSU fan base, which is so weird that we put so much emotion in all this, but I love it. Baby. It gives me something to live for. I guess, and my daughters as well, and my wife, and all the rest of my family and friends and everybody who I love very much, of which I guess you're among that crew, Brody. So thank you for giving me a reason to live beyond LSU football. We'll see where it goes. We'll be back next week where we can talk about the Alabama game, which, good on us, we avoided mentioning it the entire show today because that's going to be fun. I will say this, Brody. The thing that makes me most depressed about more hopeless than anything with Bo Pelini is the continued utter failure of the air raid in the SEC. And it culminated with Alabama holding Mississippi State to 200 total yards. They did have a drive over 7 yards in the first quarter. What else did I read in that Athletic article? Devontae Smith outgained all of Mississippi State alone. Also, it's the only time in Mike Leach's history as either head coach or assistant that he has not scored a point. And again, that is the offense that
shattered gave up
600 yards and 6 touchdowns too. So I don't know, dude. I don't know. We'll see where it goes. And we'll talk about Alabama next week. So there's a little preview for y'all on the Hold That podcast, theathletic.com/holdthatpodcast. $1 a week sign up deal. It is so worth it, y'all. Trust me, I love this site so much. You will too. And go buy your meats at A-Bear Specialty Meats if you're in Bocage and Baton Rouge. And we will see you next week on the Hold That podcast.